So, okay, so I'm just going to look at chapter 9 to begin with. Those of you who want to follow it in the book. So this is the chapter called The Living Image and the Body of Glory. Because what we're looking at here, when we look at this pathway, when we look at this movement through the veil, and look at this process of death and resurrection, we're looking at the image of ourselves and the universe that has been created. And we're looking at the transformation of that image, specifically the dismantling of that image and the recreation and the creation of a new image. And in the Kabbalah, the word for image is zelim, which is tzadi lamed mem. And you find it in the book of Genesis. And God created man in his image. In the image of God did he create him. Male and female created he them. Now the root meaning of zelim is shadow or representation. And this is really related to this whole dynamic of the icon and the idol that I talk a lot about. Because we have to be a shape. But the whole point of incarnation is we exist in a shape that can participate with other shapes. Now, but the question that's underneath this is, how much does our shape allow the deeper part of our nature to come through us? Or how much does our shape obstruct that? So in a certain sense, how much of us is an icon and how much of us is an idol? Because the nature of the icon is a shape that enables the uncreate light to pass through it, and can shape shift, can be fluid, can be kind of responsive to whatever is coming at it externally and whatever is coming through it internally. So it's a meeting point, it's a doorway, a gateway between the inner world and the outer world. Now, if our shape is rigid, if our shape is self-referential, if that whole process around Hod and Netzach and Yesod is mainly based upon experiences that have happened to us in the past and is designed to keep ourselves safe from the threats we have experienced in the past, that creates a shape that will limit our capacity to respond both outwardly and inwardly. Because it will divert both the impulses coming from the deeper parts of the tree and will cause us to respond in stereotypical way to things that are coming at us from the outer universe. And in a sense, it's like, because what happens is that the dynamic, you know, so the image, it's not a static image, the Zelim, it's created, it's continually created and recreated. So it's a bit like an eddy in the water. It's a sort of like a sort of shape that creates it, that keeps creating itself. And that can, and then that shape is created by, if you think of an eddy in the water, that's normally created by things that are underneath the water that can't be seen. So the surface shape that we have is created by decisions, by blocks of memory, energy, feeling, thought that have coagulated together to protect ourselves in different ways. And these have interlinked together to form a coherent shape that links with a sort of a coherent image of how the universe is. So what that does is, just as in the river, it creates a turbulence, so water flows in a particular way, constantly. Now, if we think, if we apply the kind of Pades formula here, what we do, in order to know yourself, in order to know your shape, you begin by just noticing who you are, literally the surface of who you are. You know, this is my age, this is my job, this is what I do, this is how I respond, this is how my body feels today. So we begin by just contemplating that. This is who I am. Now the problem, it's a more difficult problem doing it with our sense of ourselves than say with a coffee cup, because there's so much more material that comes flooding in. You know, there's enormous things that we know about. You know, when things you start thinking about yourself, memory floods up, things come appear, all kind of things appear. So partly you have to just keep slowing the process down a little bit, okay. Because what happens is that the whole point about the internal dialogue that constitutes the veil paraketh, it's intended to look outwards. It disturbs that dialogue to be reflected upon. So what happens is that momentum, all that momentum that's in the internal dialogue, as you start to look into the nature of that itself, tries to push you out of it again. And so you create, it's a bit like putting a stick into this kind of turbulent thing. So it creates more turbulence. So you get flooded by thoughts, memories, ideas, that can easily just spin you off. And quite often what happens when you try to do this, you find yourself thinking about some memory and you get lost in that memory for ages. And then you think, oh my God, what's I supposed to be doing? Oh yeah, I'm supposed to be reflecting on myself. And that's nothing wrong with that. That's just natural process. That's what happens. So, but as you persist in that, and if you can just persist in that little by little, you start to get a sense of both a sense of the shaping that is you and a sense of something that's underneath that. Now that is the hint. That's the sort of, and the underneath that is the presence of Tiferet, which is this small, still, so just in a moment you touch something or you feel something. And actually, the thing is that underneath there is enormous capacity. We just are screened off from that. But and what you're touching as you touch into that hint place is the presence of the angel in the pool. So you're stepping towards the angel by persisting in your inquiry. The angel steps towards you in response. And then if we come to the third place, if you like, the kind of then having caught the hint, not letting so touch that place of where there's something there, some stillness, some aliveness, something that we want to inquire into. As we persist in that, we come into this process that sometimes called the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, where a dialogue starts to develop between ourselves and that still and silent presence in Tiferet. And we start to little by little start to be able to notice these hints much more. We notice synchronicities, we notice that silent presence within us. And what starts to happen then, as that happens, is the direct connection between Tiferet and the lower and that lower triangle starts to happen. And that starts to interfere with the known sense of self. Now, if you like, one of the ways of thinking about this is that if you like the Zelim, in a way, worked with Zelim is rather like the devil card. It's this solid shape that says this is how things are and nothing is going to change. And as we investigate the nature of that, as we saw the last weekend, we start to discover that actually we can get past this. That actually there's a way of freeing ourselves. And that what's underneath that figure is raw energy, raw creativity that can move in a different way, maybe. What we start to discover in this weekend is as we do this, as we look more into this, as we cooperate with that kind of that presence of Tiferet, we start to let go of things. Things start to die. And that's scary, and it stirs up. So what starts to happen is that solid form starts to disarrange itself. It starts to break up. Now to come back to the word Hebrew word zelim, the Hebrew and the verse in Genesis that is taken from, the phrase in Genesis and is bet zelim. And that can mean, it doesn't mean in the image, it can also mean with the image. And the letter Beit, which is the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is the archetypal house, the archetypal temple. And in a certain sense, the true image of the human being, which is in a certain sense the minister of the light, the minister of the blessing, is the priest or priestess who stands in the temple and who allows the light to come through, and who meets the conditions of the world with the radiance and the blessing that comes through from the deeper place. Now the word Zelim itself, it's three letters, Zadi, Lamed, Mem. Now the word letter Zadi is called the fishhook. It's just a fishhook. You pluck things out of the river from. It's also the first letter of a word in Hebrew called zadik, and the zadik is the true human being. It's the adept who is in the service of the light. In its form, it's got a sort of slightly bent shape, and the rabbis will talk about it as the humility of the tzaddik that is constantly bowing in prayer, constantly bowing, and also bowing down to reach into the world of fragments to rescue the lost souls. Now the second letter of Zelim is Lamed. Lamed is the ox goad, but it's also the place of perfect balance. And so one of the key qualities of the true human image is being that axis, being this place of connectedness that works with the energies of the opposites. So if you like, the intention is to be the tzaddik, to be the one who allows the light to penetrate, who goes into the dark places to rescue the beings that are lost. But in order to do that, it requires the capacity of perfect balance. Not a balance, a dynamic balance, not a static balance, but a capacity to be in disturbed situations and to find the access point, to find the point that connects in the middle of disturbance. Now if we come back to the word Zadik for a moment, the word Zadik itself is spelt Zadi Dalet Yud Kof. Now the first letter is Zadik, is Zadi, which we've just described. Dalet means the door. So the adept is both, is also the doorway. It also the tzaddik contains the letter Yud, which is the letter of will and creativities, and then final letter Kof represents the back of the head. Now the tzaddik, this word begins by the letter of Zadi, which in itself is a letter of bowing and surrender. also embraces its nature as being the doorway, the icon that connects things, but is the vehicle of the divine will, which is this tiny letter yod, which is like this voice of the silent voice of the intuition. And this, and the letter kaf in particular, relates to automism, relates to the back, relates to the back of the head, the hind brain, and so it's about the bringing of the these qualities of presence, of will, of perception into the unconscious reactive kind of places. Now, if we remember when we're looking at the Hebrew notion of the biblical notion of the word sin, where we have these three words, we have chatah, which is reactivity, which is ignorance, automism. Underneath chatah, we have a deeper level of ignorance that's called peshah, which is about willful, I will do what I want. And then beneath this, there is the word avon, which is the delight in iniquity. It's the energy of apophysis, the energy of inertia that wants to stop the world of the universe, the movement of the universe, and delights in that. Now, all these, in a certain sense, are aspects of what's represented by the letter kaf. The doorway is in that automatic reactivity, but you go more deeply into disturbance, more deeply into separation, as you follow the path of the Tzaddik. Now, what helps you to stay there is this connection with the letter Yud, which is this deep will that arises from the deeper parts of ourselves. And the field of operation is given in this final letter, Mem, which is the waters of the sea, which is the sea of the collective imagination, the collective sea of consciousness that we all live in. And in a certain sense, the thing above all that the Tzaddik does, that the priest or priestess does, is to bless. Berak Hei, the blessing. So blessing is really the actual act of blessing is to renew, to bring things into alignment. You know, that place where things are brought home out of separation, and that where dialogue and conversation becomes possible again. Now, the true human form then really is the being who can do this, so the being who can be transparent to the light, can and through the shape-shifting capacity can meet whatever of the conditions of life that are needed to enable that act of blessing to function. So you find reference really to in the Kabbalah to this idea of the body of light, sometimes called the body of glory. And this is the illuminated body. This is the shape that we are when we are icon. So it's the capacity to be fluid, the capacity to reach out, the capacity to allow ourselves to be shaped by something deeper than our known self, so that we touch others as they need to be touched. Now that touch can be a gentle touch, it can be a sometimes a very clear and forceful touch. But it's the capacity really to more and more deeply be present with whatever is unfolding in that moment, without reservation. And the surrender that's involved in that moment is absolutely this process of death and resurrection. I say the shocking thing, I do the shocking thing, I make the decision I didn't know I was going to make. And in that moment, I don't know whether that decision is right or not. I'm just going with it. I'm just trusting. Not even trusting it, letting it happen. Now, the complicated thing around all this, that they're making, of course, peace sound very simple when I say that, but actually the problem is, one of the problems of the way the dialogue works is it co-opts ideas like this. It co-opts ideas like intuition or the will of God or the deeper self. So we can sometimes think that we're operating from that place while actually operating from little images inside ourselves that are part of the internal dialogue. And so the process of inquiry is perpetual. We check ourselves out. So when you've done something like that, you check out afterwards. Well, okay, did that? What was I up to in that? Was I really coming from the deep, mysterious place, or was I coming from another place? So this place of self-examination and recognizing our capacity to delude ourselves, is really important. Part of this important reflection is to really know our tendencies. So if our tendency is to believe ourselves, when we're doing self-reflection, lean a little into disbelieving ourselves. See what that does. If our tendency is to disbelieve ourselves, we'll do the other thing. There's a great Thai meditation master called Ajahn Chah, lived in northeast Thailand, an extraordinary being. And he used to get into trouble a lot because people used to accuse him of being inconsistent in giving advice. Because somebody would say, well, he said that thing to that person, another thing to another person. Well, this week you're telling me to do this, and last week you told me to do that. And he had a great gift for saying things very simply, Ajahn Chah. He said, well, it's like this. If I see somebody walking to a ditch and about to fall off to the left, I say, go right. If I see them walking on the right-hand side of the ditch and about to fall off, I say, go left. And it's a great image because it's just straightforward. It's really look at, okay, see what your tendencies are doing. Know your habitual tendency and do the other thing. Because the thing about the known sense of self, right, the shaped sense of self, is it's really got a lot of momentum, and it's also clever, right? So it could very easily co-opt ideas like intuition, ideas like the Tiferet Tree of Life. And so you can very easily create a rather beautiful spiritualized version of yourself that's designed to keep you safe and think that you're operating from there when actually you're operating from a layer within the veil parakeet. A distinguishing feature of the actual contact is that sense of disruption that accompanies it. And literally, you don't, when you're really in that flow, you don't even know what you're going to say before you say it. But sometimes what you're going to say comes not out of that place, out of the place of me, part of me that likes to be a spontaneous creative teacher. Right? So sometimes, hopefully, I'm operating from that deeper place. Other times I'm operating from a slight, not terrible place, but a shaped place that knows how to teach, say.
David Bowie says really in his song Changes, because as soon as I read this chapter, I was thinking about this. So I turned myself to face me, but I never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. And I just imagine myself chasing my tail, trying to get into this. It's a really, really clear image.
No, that's a great, that's a really good image. It's a really good image. You just keep doing it, and eventually you exhaust yourself, actually, then something else happens. But that's absolutely right. That's kind of exactly what it is. And so I think the whole place where we kind of... it is a bit like, you know, it's the dog chasing its tail. What it is, you know, eventually something stops. The important thing, I think, with this process of inquiry is to persist. And if you persist enough, stopping just happens at some point. Not for very long, but enough. And this is, in a certain sense, what Austin Osman Spare is talking about. He talks about the death posture, where he talks about the experience of exhausting yourself. He talks about creative exhaustion, and in that moment of creative exhaustion, then he has this phrase he calls the kia, the vulture self, which is his word for the kind of deeper self, which then descends upon you and grabs you, and then does something. Creates the artwork or whatever, and in a way, it's that moment of just stopping that you can't control necessarily that actually then reframes things somewhere. And in a lot of way, part of the work then is to enable ourselves to become, well, two things: to become as more comfortable with the idea of stopping, and then have to guard against the self that we then start to create, that is the spiritualized self that's comfortable with stopping. You know, so there's just something about that, you know, that creative capacity that's in the internal dialogue that gets, so you pursue it at subtler and subtler levels. That's the key, in a sense. So if we think of it as an opaqueness that's created not by a lot of the heavy dirtiness, but by lots and lots and lots of layers. So that's where the opaqueness of the image comes from. So as you strip one bit off, there's another bit, another bit, another bit, another bit, another bit, another bit, and eventually there's a kind of clarity for a moment. And then, of course, what happens, you see, is that if you like, that beam or light from the angel or presence from the angel descends into the pool, moves from the unknown to the known, and becomes part of the material of the dialogue. So there's a sort of infinite creativity required in this, really, which is it's not about being clever at all. It's really about, okay, just come back to the beginning again, look again. You just come, you know, the simplicity of the Pardes meditation is really important. Because all you do to begin again is you just start again. You look at the surface. Start again, look again. Hang out with it. Notice the hint. Pursue the hint as far as you can. See what revelation appears, be with that. Good. You're touched by that, that starts to alter things. Next moment you're back in the dialogue again. Start again. Right? It's that spiraling kind of process that little by little brings us into this different sense of ourselves.
Ian, can I just say something?
Yeah.
What that sounds like is we are forever caught in the bottom triangle,
no,
trying to get glimpses, yeah, and take them back with us.
Aye.
As opposed to moving into.
No, well, what happens is, so this is an important thing to say, Duncan, thank you. So what happens, right, as we gradually do that, is our range of capacity to penetrate the veil increases. So the veil becomes increased. So what happens is, as we get used to this process of catching the hint, inquiring, touching. What happens, if you like, there is a deepening underneath dialogue that happens. Our presence steps more strongly into the inner, and the innermost place steps outwards. So what starts to happen is a conjunction happens between Yesod and Tiferet. That's where a new sense of self starts to come into being. Where actually then it's like what happens is that veil starts to thin, and we become, our range of understanding of ourselves starts at first just to incorporate Tiferet. So we become we somewhere our locus of, so in the middle, for the beginning, our focus of consciousness is pretty much in the middle of Yesod, surrounded by these things. What happens is our locus of consciousness starts to move inwards towards Tiferet. So that increasingly, if you like, the gravitational effect of the inner dialogue becomes less. And eventually, as we start to more and more locate ourselves in Tiferet, we're still dealing with the internal dialogue, but we're doing it from a different point of balance within us. So we're working with it from underneath the scene. So there's a flip, there is a transfer from being within it and reaching to something that feels outside us, to being outside the dialogue and moving into it to transform it. So
Sorry, I was going to just...
Yeah.
I have something in addition, because I get that. What I was wondering more is, I'm sorry if this is very basic terms, does the sort of magnetic pull of the lower triangle ever lose its power, or do you think you've just shifted, it's like you shifted out of it? Because the whole thing about seeing, getting high and then...
Yeah.
Falling back.
Eventually it changes, right? Because what happens is you create these connections. So Hod becomes connected to Geburah. Chesed becomes connected to Netzach. Tiferet directly connected to Yesod. So what starts to happen is instead of it operating as an autonomous unit, it becomes part of a much larger kind of cycle. So basically, at that point, the veiled paragraph doesn't really exist, because you're then living in a much bigger kind of field. Your focus is in Tiferet, so there's much more fluidity and movement in the whole structure. So then that lower triangle just does what it's intended to do, right? Where thought and feeling and image then are, if you like, at the service of this greater sense of self, greater sense of being. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is something about Karuna there, when they talk about that place of witness consciousness, but
yeah,
where this becomes, I don't know if you could describe the differences a bit better.
Well, witness consciousness,
something is alive about this place, isn't there, but still has that.
Well, the beginnings of witness consciousness are where you touch into Tiferet, where you just can't, where you disidentify.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and of course, that's part of this. When we're talking about the death aspect of this path, partly you're disidentifying with the known self. So you're touching into that place where then, and increasingly then, as you can touch into that place, it is like you start to, because you're not caught in the thoughts and feelings and images and sensations. There's a place where you're kind of witnessing them from behind the scenes. Right, and that's just, if you like, a sort of a place, it's a good place. It's a place where you can, where you're not just immediately reactive, where you've got choice, where you've got a bit of space. But it's a bit like what Duncan was saying earlier, that would still leave us with this kind of witnessing, this kind of magnetic kind of pull doing his thing all the time. Whereas the stage beyond that, in a sense, really, is a sort of a deepening incarnation of that presence coming down into these different spheres and them coming into a different kind of dialogue. So then it's not witnessing from a distance. You're in the presence is in the middle of the experience.
It's that move from hunter to warrior, isn't it? And being more immersed in the experiencing, you're getting the blessing in that place.
You're
in the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right in the experience, but the presence, that spacious presence, is in the heart of the feeling, is in the heart of the thought, is in the heart of the image, and is in the heart of the physical sensation. Mm. So there isn't a sense of separation like that. I'm not sitting back witnessing. I mean, that's an important stage, that place where you can sit back and witness, because then you start to discover how your thoughts and feelings can drag you into situations. But in order for those things to be transformed, that presence has to step into those conditions and enable something different to happen there, really.
So I've got a question.
Mm-hmm.
How do you kind of know where you are, or is that just too simple a question? Are you always in different places, and are different aspects of you in different places? And
well, the way the Tree of Life can be really useful at times, I think, is you can look at yourself on the tree and just see, well, where am I located at the moment? You know, am I mainly looking? You know, if we think of, you know, so if we think of you know, Malkut as the body, and you think of Hod as the mind, and Netzach as the feelings, and Yesod as the life energy and the conditioned imagination. If we look at Geburah as our relationship to the quality that's of Mars, Hesed to the quality of Jupiter in compassion, Tiferet to the sun, Bina to Saturn, Chokmah to the stars, Keter to the you know, the divine source, in a sense. So that gives us a basic kind of structure, which I'm going to talk about after our tea break, where we can look at ourselves, and just you can use that the tree is a mirror in that way. So where am I at the moment? Am I looking, you know, so I'm talking to you at the moment, so I'm really, and I'm thinking, and I'm trying to be clear. So there's a lot of activity in me going on between Geburah and Hod, and also Yesod, because I'm using images and things that I'm not, you know, I'm analyzing myself in this moment. I wasn't thinking this right now, but you use the tree as a way of looking at where am I and what am I doing. And you use the paths. The paths give you the relationship between the parts of yourself. And in a way, the thing that I'm going to talk about after the tea break, which is about this mirroring process, because you can use the tree in a very detailed way. You can use it in a very broad brush way, as in the service of your inquiry. Right, so if I want to look more about what happens in me in the principle of between will and thought, will and thinking, I can look at my relationship between Geburah and Hod. And then I think, okay, I really want to look at thinking. Do I want to look at will or thinking? Oh, I know, I'll look at thinking. So then I think, okay, I'm going to look at the tree within Hod. Right, which is where I'm not going to do that. I'll talk about that. But that's where you start. Right, you start by thinking, okay, let me look into that. I'll look at, because I want to really understand about my thinking. If I wanted to understand my relationship to will, I'd look at Geburah. And how does will, and I might look at, okay, so if I look at Geburah and I would look at how does my will and clarity translate into thought, I would look at Hod of Geburah. And if I wanted to look at, okay, so Hod of Geburah gets me to look at how my will, my clarity relates into thinking. So that's Hod of Geburah. I'm looking at thinking, rather look at clarity, and I'm looking at my thinking within clarity. And if I wanted to look, well, how can I do that in a balanced way? I would then look at the Tiferet of Hod and Geburah. Or if I was thinking, well, actually, maybe you get... If I look at my thinking that comes out of that clarity place, but how does my thinking about the thinking work? I would look at Hod of Geburah.
Oh dear!
Right, but the thing is, if I take it in an outside way, right, that's ridiculous. It's like how one thing leads to another, right? So I start off by thinking, okay, let's see how my ability to be clear works in my thinking. Okay, so I look at Geburah, and I look at Hod, and I look at the relationship, and so I look at Hod of Geburah, which really starts to, I understand that. But if I want to look in more detail at how that principle of clarity within thought operates in this place, then I look at the Hod of Hod. Right. So that, but that's because I've got interested in that underneath energy. I'm following it in a natural kind of way. And then I might want to look, well, how does that translate into image? So then I would look at the Yesod of Hod of Geburah. Right, now from outside, this sounds utterly crazy. And if you take it as an external process, of course, but it is how one thing leads on to another thing.
Yeah, and you're looking at the relationships within that aspect.
Yeah, and you're using the tree as a sort of a mirror to help you do that. Right, and that's one of the great things about the tree diagram. It's like the like an ultimate systems diagram. You can look at it, and because what you're doing, it's a map of relationships fundamentally. So you're looking at how one thing talks to another thing. So you can look at, you know, so you can look at how, you know, for example, how do, if we take the other side of the tree, we could look at, well, how does kindness function here? How does the, that quality of love in Gedula, how does that translate down into the teaching experience? You know, so, the, okay, because you can get very wrapped up in thought and cleverness and kind of, and can be very, it can be very intimidating and can be quite unkind to do that. So that clarity of Gebura needs to be, you know, so if I'm very wrapped up in my thoughts and my ideas and my kind of, and wanting to get that as clear as kind of possible, well, that's fine, and that can lead me into very, very detailed stuff, which could be quite unkind to my listeners. So I have to find a way to bring in that other quality from of Gedula, and then find a way to balance that in Tiferet somewhere. So that, I mean, that's the way that, you know, the way you can use the tree. That's one of the great abilities of the tree, I think, where you can look at the, you know, you've got 10 spheres, you've got 22 paths, and these are all diagrams of relationship that you can use to explore different aspects of yourselves. You can also do it in relationship to other people. You can look at how your tree relates to another person's tree. I quite frequently do that in my therapy work, where I look at, you know, how are the, because what happens is when two people work together or know each other, what you find is, you know, the relationships between the spheres of the tree kind of alter, and you create a, there's a joint conjoint field formed where aspects of one tree in one person interact with aspects of the tree in the other person. And you can start to see, well, okay, when I'm with this person, I'm like this, and parts of me get expanded, other parts of me contract. And if I think of their trees, maybe that happens to them as well. So in a way, it's a way of being able to kind of explore, take this Pardes process and apply it in a kind of focused way. And that's the balanced way to do it. That's the way that, because actually, we have to come back all the time to the fundamental inquiry. The danger of this of the tree is it turns into a cognitive nightmare where people get fascinated by the detail. You know, there's a.
Say you want to look at an aspect of like something from your childhood and you're thinking, okay, that's come up and I can see that and I want to change that.
Yeah.
You do that on the tree.
Yeah, you could do that on a tree. So what you would do is you take that memory, right? And then you'd look at how that memory works on the tree. So you'd look at the
behavior, or does it have to be a memory?
Well, you're remembering whatever it is. You're remembering something, right? Yeah. Something comes up, so it is a memory, okay? And it will involve behavior. It'll involve. So what you start to do is to look at that experience on the tree. Malchus there to help you look at the physical situation this arose out of. And also not just physical situation, but the actual behavior, what happened, right? This would all be part of the action quality of Malchut. Underneath it, you might look at the kind of images, the kind of the things, the underpinning of it in Yesod. You might look in Hod and Netzach, might help you understand the thinking and the feeling that's embedded in that situation. And the different paths would enable you to look at how these different things interacted. How did thought, you know, so let's say something painful happens in the past. We start off, and it's again, it's the same Pardes process. You start off by looking at the literal situation and gathering that, and then you start to look more deeply into it. So you start to see, okay, what was underneath? What's the Yesod gives you the foundation of that place. Hod and Netzach gives you the thinking and the feelings that were around that enabled that thing to happen. And the different paths really will help you look, well, how did one thing lead to another? So you can kind of unfold the situation. And you can unfold it further. You can look at where was Tiferet in that situation, or where wasn't it? Was the tree balanced in that? Was the deeper passage of the tree balanced in that? Was there maybe too much Geburah or too much Gedulah? Where was the capacity for the mysterious quality of the art to come in, or maybe it wasn't? Right. So there's, you can use the tree in all kinds of ways like that to really explore and expand and open a situation out, so that it becomes more visible to you.
Thank you. Can I just ask you, what's happening when you get really fed up with yourself and really fed up with self-analysis?
I don't know, Holly. What do you think is happening?
Well, at times in discussion that you were having, and in what you were saying earlier, with this sense of disturbance that comes when you're kind of... break away from the inner dialogue a bit, it feels like it could be a good thing.
Yeah.
And it does sometimes feel like a relief. It feels like I've got fed up with all this.
Yeah, of course. No, totally.
Big potatoes or something. And other times it can feel like it's a frustration with not being able to penetrate deeper, just like, you know, longing to kind of get through something, not being able to kind of exhaustion. The key doesn't always arise.
No, of course not. No, I think that's the whole thing, isn't it? I mean, this is a creative art. So sometimes it's really important just to go and dig potatoes. Sometimes it's really important to hang out with the frustration, and until something shifts. You know. So the whole thing about this is the whole idea of dynamic balance. So if you get very, very stuck in one place, then move to the other place. But the complicated thing is you have to try, and again, it all comes back to trying to trust that deeper sense of knowing, but when is the right time to do that or not? And actually getting fed up with ourselves isn't a bad thing, I think. I mean, it's a sort of, in some ways it's quite a helpful thing, because actually there's something about getting, the more we do get fed up with the known parts of ourselves, the easier it is to step away from them. Because it is like we're living in a sort of... because actually the problem, the overall problem, no matter how functional the internal dialogue tries to be, it's a stale place. It's a place that just recycles. Because that's its quality. It exists as a, it's in service of a known past.
Can I just ask you something that might relate to that, Ian?
Yeah.
Yes, or did images rather than symbols? Because the whole analytical idea is that symbols come up as messages from the unconscious. I'm just wondering if images are like include symbols, or just are more like memory and...
No, images are both symbols, and well, they can be any images that you've got. You have present images. You have images that come up from the unconscious, which would have a symbolic nature. So there's a whole, you know, where in that whole territory of yes, sort of all the images. So there's the surface images of the mind, if you like. There's the day-to-day stuff, and then there are these deeper symbolic images that emerge from the unconscious. Sometimes from the, you know, if you like, what we might call the Freudian unconscious, things from our early life, things from the collective unconscious, so all of that would be under the category of images, really. And in a sense, yes, Odd, it has got all these different kind of layers inside itself. You know, so if you like, it's a sort of, it's on, you know, this almost that image that Jung gave us of a house where you just keep digging into the foundations, you find other houses underneath it. So there's I feel like, yes, so there's this conglomeration of images that are organized by aspects of the internal dialogue, really. And but underneath there are these powerful collective kind of images.
I was wondering, there must be things that are different images.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, the whole thing about it, yes, what is it? It's sometimes called this place of sweet and bitter waters. So there are. It's a mingling of things, right? So there's the whole thing about this dialogue, is it's a mixture of bright images, dark images, icons, idols. It's all a kind of so there's absolutely Tiferetic images in there. There's kind of things of beauty that open up the senses and open up the body, and other things that close things down, really.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's a crossroads.
Yeah, totally is a crossroads. Absolutely is that. It's a place where, well, I mean, it literally is on the tree, because you've got these three paths that kind of, four paths actually, that come together in it, and sort of, and so it's actually a very important point. And interestingly, it's parallel place in the tree is d'art. So the d'art is another crossroads place where another major kind of transition kind of point. But d'art is the place of the unknown, the mysterious, the doorway to the non-dual. And so there's a real kind of parallelism you get between the experience of both places somewhere. And which we'll talk about later. Okie dokie. Let's have a break for half an hour to 25 minutes or something, and come back at 4 o'clock. And have a nice tea break.